Hello, this is Liz Dunchy, Managing Editor of CCR Corp. Welcome to today's podcast and hello to all of the members of the CorporateCouncil.net who are listening. I'm talking today with Carl Hagberg, who has a long career in the securities industry, including a special focus on proxy voting issues and retail investor relations. Carl has chaired and run Carl T. Hagberg & Associates since 1992, which helps companies optimize their spending on individual investors and on investor relations programs in general. Carl also heads a team of 50 independent inspector of elections who, through June, served at over 550 shareholder meetings for numerous Fortune 500 companies down to small and microcap companies, which provides him with really great insights into the great, the good, the bad, and the mostly rare ugly meeting events and things we need to watch for going forward. Since 1992, when Carl founded and continues as the senior editor of the Shareholder Service Optimizer, which is a quarterly advisory letter, which is always full of practical advice for issuers and for their key advisors and service suppliers. Carl has also served as an expert witness in dozens of cases involving securities processing, record keeping, and voting related issues. Any day that I get to talk with Carl is a good day, even on days that we have some technical difficulties like we had with this podcast. And this conversation is somewhat of a follow-up post-proxy season conversation to the predictions that Carl shared during the conduct of the annual meeting webcast that we held in March. So welcome to the show, Carl, and thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Liz. It's always fun to talk to you. People probably know this. We have our little secret jokes secret people that we poke fun at who deserve it. But in any way, in any event, I'm
nobody happy. Who's listening, just to be clear.
No, never any clients. I learned that the hard way. Never say anything negative about a client. But in any event, let me start off, if I could, with just a couple of observations about the 2022 season that jumped out at me. There were actually a number of things that were quite different and took me by surprise. So I'll give you a few of them because it's worth thinking about this in case you may fit the bill here, and then I'll let Liz fire some questions at me. But the first thing that really struck me is that, you know, about 15 years ago, annual meeting season ended at the end of April, the last business day of April. Most companies still today are on a calendar year, and so they would close their books. They would go like 60. They'd assemble their team, write their proxy material, get it printed, get it in the mail, and be done, all in all done, the 30th of April. And over time, this has moved away. So April is in the dust. It's actually one of the slower months. And May had been, last year, was by far the busiest month. And lo and behold, this year in June tied with April for meetings that we did. And we're a pretty good proxy for the world as a whole, I think, at least for companies that get help with their annual meetings. And so I was quite surprised. And so we were tied, and May had a 32% plus increase over last May. And people have been saying to me, what's going on here? Well, from my perspective, what's going on here is it's getting harder and harder and harder every year to get all of this stuff together. I think companies have a harder time getting all their key players together in the same place at the same time. Certainly, we all know the SEC has added more and more rules, and the ESG movement has really added an imperative for companies to explain themselves in excruciating detail about their ESG policies. And so, lo and behold, there's more and more stuff to do. More and more people are working remotely. Oddly enough, I'm sure this isn't true of every company, I'm glad, but many companies have had sort of a brain drain. The old time masters of meeting matters retired, And many times the jobs are broken up or new people came in. And so often the key people that you need both in your company and from your supplier team, your outside counsel, your proxy solicitors and advisors, your VSM manager, you know, they're new. You get a lot of newbies and they don't bring all that experience to bear. So you kind of have to be aware of that. And I think part of my message is start early to pick your day. Because there are only so many hours in the day in May and June when you can hold a meeting. You can have it really at 9 o'clock at night. The directors will flip out and your stockholders will too. And so there's like a lot of compression. There's vying for dates and availability and web time and the time of your best teammates and suppliers. And so be sure you get your date early. Be sure the date and time. Be sure you get the A team. Don't settle for the B team. Oh, God forbid, the B minus team. And so that's the one thing that really jumped out at me when I looked at the calendar, how compressed it's become. And it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. Although meetings now, we look at September, and September is turning into a very big month. December, which was, it was like anti-religious to have a meeting in December. Well, we have a lot of meetings in December. But if you're in that busy season, I say get your date, get your team together early on, and that's that. The second thing that struck me was how much more weighty proxy materials have become. And by this, I mean in avoirdupois, in thinking and in, you know, not always so good. And, you know, if anything, a lot of the meat of what your stockholders really want to know about and need to know about to cast an informed vote gets buried in gigantic piles of minutiae, you know? And I've been saying this for over 10 years, I really think there needs to be a committee to overhaul the package, the annual meeting shareholder package, to shorten it, simplify it, send more stuff to the footnotes or to the eager beavers who have plenty of time to read on this minutia. But so I went to move a stack of, annual reports. And I went, what the heck happened here? It was like 20% heavier than last year. And if you remember, 7 years ago, many of you will remember, starting around then, the big thing was to cut down, use thinner paper, you know, tissue paper that you could practically see through, get rid of the glossy report, get rid of the cover, get rid of all those things saying vote now, and cut down on paper, cut down. Well, that failed dismally. And ESG has a lot to do with that people are demanding more and more and more disclosure. And it's piling up into the weight of the material, but the weightiness, the intellectual weightiness, I think, is getting lost here in this pile of stuff. So I was actually kind of shocked by that. And so that's...
And Carl, yeah. Are you saying that you would recommend each company that they form a committee to try to reduce the volume of their proxy materials?
That would be good. But I think there's really, to put it quite bluntly, I think the SEC needs to give us the cliff notes to, you know, send us the cliff notes or the highlights. We don't have hours. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of investors, you know, who don't have to vote legally, don't vote. And so give us what we need in the first go round, and then give us a link where we can just click the button, go right to the voting site and be done. And yes, if you feel you must send us 150,000 pages, well, God bless. But, you know, or let us opt out, or give us a link where we can see each of the pieces of the report if we want to study closely. I actually do study some of this stuff pretty closely. I have my own list of directors that I feel should not be directors. And if I see any of them, I quickly vote no. But most people don't need to have that. You know what I mean? And so that's what I think. I think the SEC and the industry together should be saying, wait, we have gone way too far. There's too much stuff in this pile. for people to successfully digest, you know, and we need to give people what they need to know to cast their vote the minute this lands on their desktop. And that's the way I think we should be thinking, you know.
Yeah.
And because, as I say, every year, when we get the new climate guidelines, you know, that's probably going to add 50 more pages to this stuff that's already there.
At least.
And so it's time to call a halt and a rethink. And I understand the SEC wants every little detail in the record somehow or other, but it's not for the average investor, and they don't need it to make an informed decision about most of the matters. And if it's too complicated for them, they can always abstain, or they can go to the encyclopedia and look stuff up if that's what they want to do. So that's kind of my take on that. Okay, there's a couple more. Let me see where the heck they are. I want to say this. ISS, there's a lot of misinformation about meetings, which I hope you'll discover in the course of this webinar. But ISS briefly put out a thing. Liz, I think you printed it in your blog that VSMs were waning, okay? Well, I don't know what they were thinking of or where this came from, but by my statistics, no. They're not waning at all. They're here to stay. I think ultimately this will be the vehicle of choice for most companies. There are some companies where the chairman loves the meeting, okay? I know many, and they're great, and they really run great meetings, okay, in person, and they like to play to the audience, and I like to see them because I'm great. I'm a person who bets the jockey, so I look at these jockeys closely to see if they're telling me the truth or they're telling me everything or they're hedging their bets. But in any event, I have a quick number for me. Out of the 525 meetings we did through mid-June, only 84 were in person, or 16%. I do think this number will gradually creep up because for very small companies, it's probably overkill to go to their lawyer's conference room and to do this thing themselves, and maybe even webcaster from there, broadcaster from there, or just to have the meeting where no one comes and there are no questions. And of course, if a lot of people come and they come with questions and they're angry, well, that's a different story altogether. But I do think that we'll see a shrinkage of virtual meetings mostly at small companies. Most of the big companies, I've been surprised how much they really love this and how it makes them prepare more carefully if they don't want to have some foul up, you know. And so I think they prepare much more carefully. The meetings are more cogent, more precise, and there's a huge saving. People were complaining about the cost of VSMs. Well, gee whiz, when I go to a big meeting and I see the fleet of cars that's bringing the directors in and out to their planes and where they're going, and you know, staff of people and security and
the cookies.
And the cookies, which are usually not really all that good. So anyway, I say, forget this. I don't say forget it. I love in-person meetings. They're never going to go away. And I think, eventually, when America gets smart, we will go straight to hybrid meetings. So you have the best of all worlds. But I'm running over my time anyway. But VSMs are not going anywhere, people. So please, guess what? There were two proponents who had proposals on the ballot. They passed overwhelmingly that you must have a virtual aspect to your meeting.
Yep.
And they're actually right. Why? Do you think it's right to insist that people have to buy a plane ticket and get on a plane and rent a hotel room to come to a meeting that lasts half an hour? No, it doesn't make sense. So that's that. Let's see. I have another myth that's making the rounds, but Liz, I know you're going to ask me about that, and that's the state of ESG. There's a lot of misinformation about that. And let me see. I think I had one more thing. Let me see. No, I'll stop here and I'll let you fire some questions at me.
All right. Well, thank you, Carl, for sharing those high-level oversights and tips for companies to think about moving forward, and advice for the SEC to think about. Those are all very helpful insights. Let's continue the conversation with talking about end-to-end vote confirmation, which is a project that received a lot of fanfare going into the season. What was that supposed to do? What was the impact? And what do you see as the next steps?
Well, I'll tell you right off what I think. A lot of sound and fury and a lot of time and energy signifying basically nothing. For a while, there was suspicion among large institutional investors that maybe their votes were getting lost in the shuffle and not being recorded. Well, guess what? Today, upwards of 96%, sometimes 98% of all votes that are recorded at annual meetings were recorded by the people themselves or by their paid agents, okay? Voting agents, all right? Lots of people hire voting agents to make sure that they cast their votes, and they do. And so individual investors, they're casting their votes on the phone by pressing buttons. And if they press the wrong button, well, too bad for them. You know, why should we have a whole big system to worry about that? And so to me, it's a big, I'd say if you looked at the way today's proxy voting system works, despite the fact it had some plumbing issues, a lot of which got worked on, and there are still some, you know, but it works better than any other electoral system I ever saw. It's highly auditable. Mistakes do happen once in a blue moon, but guess what? If BlackRock's vote didn't get recorded, they would be the first to know, and they would be the first to complain, you know? So no, I think it's sort of a tempest in a teapot. Sounds good. Works good. If people want to check to see, you know, they tell you when you call on the phone, your vote has been recorded. Well, that's enough for me, you know? And the same thing if I'm a voting agent and it says, we have received your vote. And they'll probably show you the way you voted and give you a chance to check and correct. And the burden is on you, the holder. So enough on that one. Okay.
Well, this month, the SEC's universal proxy rules go into effect. And this is an overly simplified description, but essentially, if certain conditions are met, that rule will require companies to include dissident candidates in a proxy fight on their own proxy card so that voters can pick and choose from the different slates. And my colleague John Jenkins has been doing a whole series on that over on deallawyers.com. But I'm interested in your views and whether that will put directors at risk in the near term.
Look, well, the short answer to this one is this does not make directors any more or less at risk than they were before. If you are a director at a company that's underperforming or that's had some scandals or accounting scandals or whatever it could be, you are at risk, okay? So if you're in it below the 50th percentile, in fact, if you're below the 75th percentile, you're at risk. Your directors are at risk, universal card or no. The craziest thing, all the universal card does, it actually does make it easier for people to pick and choose. They could have done that before, but most people didn't know how to do it, okay? Their tabulators didn't know how to do it. Their solicitors, in many cases, didn't know how to do it. So it will make it easier for people to pick and choose. But it's not going to save directors at companies that are in the sights. And sometimes good companies get in the sights of activists who see a chance for a quick buck. You know what I mean? So if they think, wow, we can put 3 directors out of 12 on the board, we'll change everything around, we'll get them. It gets the stock price up. The minute you announce a proxy fight, the stock price goes up, okay? And so there'll always be proxy fights. People know what they're doing. They don't start a proxy fight unless they think they have an avenue to win, which is often unknown completely to the company. They're asleep at the switch there, you know? And then they can need to convince people to vote with them. And the funny thing, there's a very good Mike Levin who publishes The Activist Investor had a nifty little webinar on this. But most people are totally missing the point about the universal proxy. And as I say, all it does, nothing's going to change. You're still going to get six versions of the blue card and six versions of the yellow card, all urging you, vote for my three, vote no against these three. But what, and they did a good job of pointing this out. It changes the dynamics in that you absolutely must, to win a proxy contest, you have to target two or three of the company directors for votes no. Okay? Otherwise, you can't get a high enough number. People will vote for me, but on the average, they're still voting for the same slate of 12 at a rate that won't let you get in unless you target two or three bad guys. People are oblivious to this in many cases. If I could tell you, I would never tell you the names and the numbers of proxy advisors and proxy communications experts, you know, who failed at the most basic thing, which is you got to target two or three people to get zero votes. So your guy will, or guys or gals, will get more than that person or those two people. And nobody seems to be doing this. And by the way, I think our firm was the only firm that would not toss cards out. So if you had two cards and they both said January 12th, they were dated January 12th, you would put them aside as setting each other off. Even if the individual had correctly voted for two on the blue and eight on the gold, okay? They weren't tabulating right in many cases, and the inspectors weren't inspecting right in many cases. So this does, it'll put the paperwork under better scrutiny, I would say. But that's the long and short of the universal proxy card, okay?
Yeah, I think a lot of the conversation around that has revolved around the possibility of lowering the cost for activists to launch a contest and maybe lowering that threshold. You don't think that that's going to play out?
Liz can see me, but she can hear the stones in my head rattling as I say, no, it's not going to lower the proxy. If anything, it'll probably make it more intense because, see, you can't say anything on the proxy card. Or under the rules, you can't electioneer on the proxy card. You have to send people to your material. So how do they get their material? They get from the fight letters. And so the dissidents are sending fight letters with their proxy, and the company is sending fight letters with their proxy. We do about a dozen proxy fights a year, mostly at smaller companies where the odds of winning, by the way, are much higher. Because a lot of companies are taken totally unaware.
That's why all companies need to be doing a vulnerability analysis, especially with these changing director expectations.
Absolutely. And you know what? So there is a little bit of extra vulnerability because every proxy advisor, every investor, activist investor, is looking harder for targets, okay?
Yeah.
As a result of all of this attention, but also because that's it. There are always going to be some companies that either are bad performers or just through bad luck or a series or maybe a spell of bad luck, they become vulnerable to being taken over by different people, okay? And so if anything, it may have changed a little bit, okay? The gap between the really compliant companies and the sloppy companies has gotten wider and wider. And so if you're one of those people who's asleep at the switch, you're in deep doo-doo, in my opinion.
Well, hopefully that's nobody listening to this episode today. But they can take that and tell their friends who might be
Well, that's
risk.
Right. And I do think, of course, their outside counsel needs, you know, if they're wise, they need to be advising them to assess their vulnerability. Long. The other very good tip that was in this webinar, again, which most people didn't think of, If you think you're vulnerable, you got to clean up your directors, okay? You got to find who are the three most vulnerable people. Oh, well, we got old George. He's 83, but he's still of sound mind. No, this guy is going to be, he's going to have a big X on his head. You know what I mean?
And poor George.
And so that's it. And Aunt Mary, whose father founded the company. No. These are the people who are going to be the first to go. And so you do need to clean this up before the activist knocks on your door or you're dead meat. You know,
absolutely.
If they are properly advised. And so many people were not really advised and they managed to scrape by. But I was going to tell you just one last thing. 2 years or so ago, we did a pretty big proxy fight and we got, I think we had something like 14,000 proxy cards. Well, they were, 32,000 proxy cards. There were only 7,000 holders and there were only 6,000 voters. And so people were voting the blue card. They were voting the gold card. They were sending faxes. And so it was a mess to figure out which was the last proxy received. And so that was pretty expensive. And the company lost, by the way, because they got bad advice. They thought that all their votes were in the bag. And they forgot that meanwhile, somebody was soliciting like crazy and getting many of these people to flip. And so it came down to a dead heat. Okay. So that was that. What's your next one?
Scary stuff. Okay. Well, let's move on to another potentially scary topic for some companies. And that is the record number of environmental and social proposals that we saw this year. You shared some ISS stats with me in advance of this podcast that said that there were 531 ENS proposals, which surpassed last year's record of 416. And the SEC only granted 9% of no action requests. It seemed like nearly every corporate secretary that I talked to this spring was kind of pulling their hair out and dealing with multiple proposals. And they felt like it had been one of the busiest proxy seasons ever. But we also blogged along the way that there were fewer no action requests submitted overall. So that suggests there were a lot of negotiations. And what was somewhat unique in this year's proposals is that they also went much further in what they're asking companies to do. And it seemed to maybe have crossed a line for some of the bigger asset managers. So there was lower average support for the proposals compared to last year and not as many passed. Does this balance out as a win for companies in your book or a loss or too close to call? And what were some of the proposals that caught your eye?
Yeah, I'll answer that question directly. Okay. This is a win for good companies. Okay. And because they're paying attention and they're engaging with activists and they're listening to them and working with them and getting the proposals withdrawn. They were withdrawn at a record rate. My friend Tim Smith at Boston Walden, 70% of the proposals that they started with were worked out. Okay.
Wow.
And this is true across the board. But this leaves the outliers, those people that are in the lower, let's say 55% or 65%, it leaves them still very, very vulnerable. But here's the thing. There was like toward the middle of the season, people were saying, including ISS, that there seems to be a falling off of investor interest in ESG. And I thought to myself, well, wait, what are you guys smoking over there? Because there's a tremendous increase in investor interest in ESG, especially in the E. The E was singled out. Well, when you go through the math, you discover a couple of things, okay? That number one, there were 50 ESG proposals that were really anti-ESG proposals. They would twist the words around. So if it was to issue a report, they would say, we want you to issue a report on the efficacy of this report and on the cost and what it, you know, and whether it was worth the effort and things like that. Like the famous group 2 years ago that said, burn more coal. You know, these are like crazy right-wing radical people who have these proposals that all regulation and rules are bad. And so 50 of them that were counted as ESG proposals and only got like less than 5% of the vote, thank goodness, they were in the ESG column. But the real number is, yes, the sheer number that went to a vote, but the bigger number, and we never really know the exact true number that were withdrawn, but we know that it's a big number, okay? Or, and because, why did they get withdrawn? Because the company got smart. They engaged, they worked with the proponent, they made some changes, agreed to do some things, and the proposal went away.
And the proponent in that case, and, like Walden, was reasonable and willing to work happy. With the companies.
And I think the same is true with As You Sow and with other groups that they listen to reason. And so if you treat them respectfully and you reason with them and you reach a reasonable compromise, most of these things can be worked out. But the bottom line is we need more E proposals. I mean, the place is burning up here, you know, and I do think once we get the roadmap for disclosure down to a more understandable and containable thing that we can kind of systemize, you'll never have one thing that fits everybody, you know. But it'll make life easier. And many of the old time proposals, asking for reports and asking for disclosures and more stuff to put in your annual report, they'll moderate or they'll be worked out offline and they won't be coming to the tables of good companies, you know, that engage. But guess what? Those climate deniers, there are still a bunch of them, and others, and or people who are just totally unreasonable, they're going to be in deep doo-doo too. And so I think that's part of it. So the real story was, I think, from a corporate perspective, the good company perspective, ESG was a good success for them, you know. And while we're not done, most people will do this without having to bring a proxy fight. And then, Liz, you mentioned BlackRock made quite a point of saying that they were giving lots of forgiveness to companies that were engaging and trying and making progress. And so that also had to do with what seemed like maybe less rabid voting on ESG matters. But ESG and E is not going away, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think companies are doing a commendable job. And one other point on your mention of the anti-ESG proposals is that I've heard some investors say that they would appreciate if companies include the name of the proponent in the proxy statement to help flag for the investors the context of the proposal and where it's coming from.
Yes. Was it your blog, I think, that told the dirty little secret about proxy information, that many times disclosing who the proponent is helps you enormously. When you see it's Jane Doe with 3 shares, you know, or guess what, with Carl Icahn with 3 pigs and 2 shares of McDonald's or something, you go, I'm not voting for this dumb thing, you know? So yes, it can help you. There was one other point you made too, that was a good one, concerning the institutional investors. And that is, see, they're getting smart too. This over-prescriptiveness, this turned them off. This was a good development, okay? When proponents had things that really were too deep and too prescriptive, even BlackRock was saying, no, I'm not voting for this damn thing. So that factored into what people were interpreting as lower numbers for ESG, okay? So in other words, they were just, they weren't getting the right story out of the numbers because they didn't see take the pieces apart. So that's it.
What lessons learned would you like to share from this proxy season? There's certainly a lot going on.
Yeah, let me get my list of things. Well, we get lessons learned. I have this short list and of what I call problem areas. Okay, so we see, believe me, we see the good, the bad, and the ugly at a lot of meetings. So here are the problem areas that I think people should be aware of and then should be very proactive about, okay? The first one, which I mentioned briefly, is this meeting congestion problem. This is getting worse instead of better. And guess what? You don't want to be hearing from your directors that, no, a 6:30 in the morning meeting is not on their list of things to do, you know, and Sunday or, you know, Columbus Day. So you need to recognize this is happening, and you need to line up your dates and your times and your A team of providers early, and it's going to get worse before it gets better, okay? The second thing is, well, just an observation, and it's had some, the good part is companies have been timing their meetings as a result to perfection. I mean, you know, if they have 1 hour, they end on the stroke of that. When that hour is up, they're done, which is good. But you've got to do this successfully, you've got to really have very careful scripting. You have to have dress rehearsals where you time out each of the things, okay? And then you allow a little bit of time for the unexpected. But the good part of the timing is good. The bad part is a lot of them have been rushing way, way, way too dangerously close to unacceptable, okay? You feel like you're in a marathon where they rush through the meeting, calling the meeting in order, bringing them, introducing the proposals, no time for discussion. Many people, many meetings that we were at, they didn't even mention the question box, okay? And so here, you know, and they weren't taking questions, or they were only taking pre-selected questions. They are running at their peril here. Originally, all of the major institutional investors said there needs to be a dialogue. There needs to be an opportunity for dialogue between the management and the directors and the investors, okay? Many, many people are flunking this test, and they're getting away with it partly because nobody's listening. You know, people are following the lead steers, but you're running on borrowed time here, and it's just not acceptable not to have a decent Q&A. I feel when you don't give somebody a chance to have a quick follow-up question, you're not running a good... That's what a dialogue is, you know? And this needs to be addressed. How we're going to fit this in to an already congested court calendar, I don't know. But people are living on borrowed time. And the good part is the activists seem to have eased up a little bit this year. I think they recognized, too, there was a lot of stuff on the agenda. Wasn't the time to make trouble. But guess what? If you get named and shamed, that in itself is a terrible thing for your company to have, okay? And so I don't know. If you had read some of my issues from last year, you would have seen some really disgraceful things at really wonderful companies. It's not like they meant to do bad, but they didn't control the Q&A properly. They didn't allow for dialogue, and it was a shameful experience, you know?
I do always enjoy just a plug for the optimizer that Carl puts out. There are so many great lessons in there, and it's not meant to shame companies. It's to show what can go wrong. And so I always look forward to those issues.
Well, good. So that's it. Don't put your meeting on speed dial. And the other thing, and Liz, if you want, I'll send you one of my latest articles on opening and closing the polls. Okay.
Yes.
A lot of companies, they're still confused and they're still conflicted on when to open the close the polls. And a lot of big companies actually adopted a system of closing the poll, keeping the polls open until the very end of the meeting. Well, that didn't work well because then there'd be this awkward silence, or they would give you, 5 seconds. I went to a meeting one of the few meetings I do myself, a wonderful company and a big company. But when I looked at the script, it said, we'll pause for 5 minutes, for 5 seconds to allow anyone to vote or change their vote. And this was a company that had 8 proposals. Well, you couldn't even change your vote on one proposal in 5 seconds, you know?
Yeah.
So I said, whoa, we got to do this. So what to do? Open the polls either immediately when the meeting convenes and then, or when you're ready to introduce the shareholder proposals, okay? When they've all been introduced and they've all had a chance to be discussed, you can allow 10 minutes, which in my opinion should be the Q&A, the minimum Q&A period. So you say, okay, proposals are done at minute 20. We're going to have a Q&A for 10. I'm telling people you've got 10 more minutes before the polls close. And then you have your Q&A. And if you have 2 minutes and you to say, we'll give you, you know, a fair warning, 2 more minutes and the time will be up. That's a nice thing to do as long as your script permits that to happen, you know.
Right.
But so that to me is the right way to do this. And but I can see why people have a bit of a problem with it. And it's more of a problem with VSMs. In the old days, you knew did people put up their hand and wave their hand in their proxy, or you see them writing and still writing. So you knew, I got to give them more time. Well, when you can't see anybody, you don't realize that they don't have time to do what they're trying to do. So that was another
one. Yeah, that's great
now
advice.
Now I had everybody's nightmare, which is the loss of connectivity during the meeting, okay? Well, the good news is...
it gives me heartburn just thinking about it.
Yeah, this is what everybody should be worried about. And it really is a nightmare in many cases, okay? And I would say probably 2/3 of this is because somebody... Yeah, like one of the directors or maybe the chairman or who knows, tries to hit the mute button on the speakerphone and hits the disconnects the whole meeting, you know?
Yeah.
But that's easy because usually as long as the internet connection is going, you're still having your meeting and you're doing what you're legally required to do, you know? But it tells you you need to have rehearsals and you need to be sure that everybody that's on that meeting knows what buttons need to be on and knows not to touch any of the off buttons, really, even the mute button, unless they know for sure it's the mute button. But we had a few where the problem did seem to be with many people being remote. Often in these VSMs, you know, there's one room with just the chairman and maybe the corporate secretary. There's another room where the directors are in a kind of a chat room or whatever. Then there's another room where the support staff is monitoring the meeting. And so the people in room 3 don't know what happened in room 1, you know?
Right.
And so one of the biggest problems would be that loss of the internet signal. So when you need to know, well, where am I broadcasting this? Where is this broadcast coming from? And is the signal strong and stable? Okay. And if not, well, you better go to another room before your meeting comes. And, but it was like slightly over 1% of all the meetings that we went to, there was a problem. And all but 2 or 3 or 4 were problems more with the conference line than with the broadcast of the meeting itself. So that's the mother load. That's what you need to protect to keep your meeting up and running, you know? And then,
absolutely,
you know, most of them have apps where you can kind of communicate, did you, you know, we lost a signal, Lord, what did you lose? Or where, you know, but that's usually, you don't want that ever to happen.
And have a hotspot or something to back you up on the fly if you really need it.
Exactly right. So that's another one. Now, wait, I got a few more here.
Oh, yeah.
2 more hot things.
Keep going.
And this is actually a nice scoop for you, Liz. You know, as we know, BlackRock delegated voting authority to a lot of the portfolio managers, clients or portfolio managers. And they just announced a bigger and bigger round. And this is coming. It's come. It's here. And we did have about three or four incidents where they were using ISS as their voting agent, okay? But it wasn't ISS's fault. It was the portfolio manager's fault, who had no clue that it was an 8 o'clock meeting. And he's sending his votes over at 9 a.m. or at 9:30. And so they didn't know what time the meeting was. They didn't realize the polls were going to close at a certain hour, usually in an hour or less after the meeting convened. And so meetings would arrive, votes would arrive late, okay? And fortunately, none of them, there was one that came close. It would have, it could have changed the outcome. It was that close, but it didn't. But so this is more a problem of education on the investor side, okay? But it certainly is a nightmare for a corporate person when they discover that 250,000 votes just arrived and the meeting was over. Sometimes, of course, they jump for joy, but usually, no. Usually it's like, wow, this is not good. So
I know BlackRock is saying that they're doing that to be responsive to their own client demands, and I can understand that, but I think it's going to create a lot of complications for companies. Yeah.
Well, they need to be sure, you know, whoever does this needs to be sure that the portfolio managers who now have the vote understand that there are finite deadlines, you know, meetings start at a given time and they end at a given time. And when the polls are closed, you don't get a do-over. You know, you don't open the voting curtains again to let people in who were asleep at the switch. So that's that. And then the last thing is, let me see. Oh, and this is a little thing, unless it happens to you. It happens mainly at small cap companies, newly public companies, where they've got a lot of retail investor ownership, and they can't get up a quorum, okay? Some is because brokers are not automatically casting votes on so-called non-routine matters, you know, on routine matters. They just said, we're not going to do this anymore. And by the way, this is going to increase because there's nothing in it for a broker to do this. It's extra work for nothing. In the old days, they thought, well, maybe they'll put me in the syndicate next time because I helped them get their quorum. Well, no, that isn't today. And so the companies are mostly small, newly public. Anybody that gets into this meme stock craze that suddenly, you know, suddenly individual investors pour into the stock. We had a few companies that went from having 30% retail to having 70% retail. Well, guess what? Then how are you going to get a quorum if 70% of your holders are moms and pops? Okay.
Right.
And so the message there is to be sure that you understand your shareholder demographics as of the record date, not as of June or April. Okay. Around your record date time, because they are the ones that, and if you suddenly discover you've got 70% retail ownership, you got to get on the ball and have a very active campaign, or you're not going to have a quorum. And most of them didn't succeed on time two. They had to go to time three.
Wow.
And we had two at time three who couldn't come up with a quorum. Okay.
Wow.
So it was only a dozen or so of the 500 odd meetings we did. But guess what? If you were one of those people, you were very unhappy. So,
yeah, and they already have a small team, and to have to keep repeating all of that work is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a new phenomenon. Usually, you know, it's not entirely new. I mean, if a company got into big trouble, all the institutions would bail and you'd suddenly become 70% retail. But it could happen to anybody, actually. So you do need to see what your demographics are at or around the time of the record date. Okay. Okay. I think that's probably it for me. You had any more questions?
I have one more question as we head into preparing for 2023, which you kind of alluded to, proxy season is now also just a year round affair. So looking ahead, what guidance do you have as companies try to prepare for the new trends that are coming down the pike?
Well, I say start now. Guess what? You know, the season is over. August happens to be a sort of a slowish month for most people. We like to take vacation, but now is the time. It used to be people would rev up their engines. Some companies maybe would start in September. Others would wait until October, November, you know. But I would say start now to get your meeting date, your meeting time, to decide whether you're going to have virtual or hybrid or in-person, okay? And then you need to be really very particular about your suppliers. You want the A team. You don't want the B minus or the C team, okay? And you don't want a bunch of newbies either if you can help it, you know? You want to get experienced people. And so those are probably the two biggest tips that I would say. And then, of course, assess your vulnerability to unfriendly attacks. And whether it's ESG matter or it's a gender or a racial or a social matter, you need to do your homework. And if you're in the bottom half, people, you know, we don't need to remind ourselves this is a multi-billion dollar industry. And so stirring the pot is what that's what their business is. So they're going to keep stirring that pot. And you just need to stir faster than them, you know, to get your own act together, and that's how to stay out of trouble, you know?
Yeah.
So that's probably it.
Well, Carl, this has been great. I always love talking with you. Thank you so much for joining me today. Is there anything that you want to promote before we go?
Promote? Well, gee, I guess I'd be a fool if I didn't say people go to the website. Go to www.optimizer.com, optimizeronline, one word, .com, and take a look at our website I call it an advisory letter now because no one can subscribe. It's against the law at companies to subscribe to newsletters, you know. You have to be an advisory service, which we are. But take a look. It's inexpensive, and it comes with free consulting on any shareholder servicing matter that ever crosses your desk. And it does, I'd say, we stay really, really close to the real world and especially to the world of service providers. We can't live without them. And you want to be sure you've got really good ones and you know what to do to avoid the sketchy ones, you know. So it's a good help there. And it's got loads of stuff. I mean, if you Google up anything, whether it's proxy or proxy fights or, you know, you'll find 5, 6, 7 articles and a lot of good templates, you know, for people. Like one of our issues, one of the things this month, what is a master ballot and why do I need it? And why do I have to have, you tell me to have my officer sign it in blank. Well, we don't really tell them to sign it in blank, but we say sign it ahead of time and we'll fill in the blanks for you. And that's what the form says. But so it's got a lot of practical stuff that could keep you out of trouble.
Yeah, it's such a helpful resource. Well, thank you again, Carl. And thanks to everyone who's listening today. And good luck with the next proxy season.